Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Washington pundits are wondering today just how much political capital President Bush is willing to spend on reforming the nation's intelligence gathering. On Saturday, despite calls from the president and vice president, Republican members of Congress unexpectedly delayed a vote on the long-awaited intelligence reform bill. But on the ABC program this week, Senator Mitch McConnell, who's the majority whip, said intelligence reform as envisioned by the 9/11 Commission is not dead yet.
The bill may be on life supports, but I think it's still breathing, and there's a good chance we'll come back December the 6th and 7th and finish it up.
Well, President Bush says he's disappointed in the delay, but is he really? We turn now to Walter Pincus, who writes for The Washington Post. And Walter, remind us first, what was this bill supposed to do?
Well, it's much more massive than people sort of realize, but the heart of it and the purpose originally was to create a national director of intelligence who would then supervise all 15 agencies of the U.S. Intelligence Committee, both foreign and domestic, and the creation of something called the National Counterterrorism Center, which would be the central place to sort of integrate all information about terrorism and do strategic planning.
Now, the big battle was over whether that national intelligence czar would have control over the intelligence budget. Who was opposed to that?
The center of the opposition was the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Duncan Hunter, but he was a stand-in for, I think, Secretary Rumsfeld, and he was also waving around a letter he got from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Myers, and testimony that he got before his own committee about their concerns that somehow a national director of intelligence outside the Pentagon would have control of Pentagon agencies that also supply tactical intelligence to the battlefield. Mm. It's an argument that people who understand how the system works thinks is overstated and is just a reason to hold up the bill to see what exactly it all means.
Well, what happened over the weekend? Because a compromise was reached on Friday and everybody seemed on board, and then what happened?
Well, what happened is the House Republicans got together in a conference, and Chairman Hunter and also James Sensenbrenner, who's chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. And the Judiciary Committee had attached a series of sort of anti-terrorism amendments to this bill, which is supposed to deal primarily in intelligence. A lot of the things they were doing had not really been subjected to any kind of hearings, and particularly not in the Senate. And so there was opposition to that. And Speaker Hastert then pulled the bill.
Now, both the president and vice president say they made calls urging passage of the bill. But some are saying, is there a wink and a nod in there? Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Republican Pat Roberts said some of the resistance to the bill was from the White House, despite what the president says about wanting it passed. So what's going on?
Well, I think everybody forgets that when the origins of this were the 9/11 Commission recommendations back in July. When they first came out, the president said he would take them into consideration. And when Senator John Kerry made it a campaign issue and supported immediate passage, then Congress started to act. But I think when the Republicans and particularly Chairman Sensenbrenner attached those riders, those terrorist amendments, it was seen as a way to weigh the House bill down. And so there are people saying that the president was going through the motions. You also have to remember the president has his own commission studying intelligence. So there's another reason to hold back, and there's a third reason, and that is the president, by an executive order, has really given more power to the director of Central Intelligence, Porter Goss, his own choice, and has ordered the establishment of the National Counterterrorism Center, which will probably go into operation in December.
Well, what do you think of the theory that President Bush does want this pushed through, that he was making sincere phone calls, and it's actually Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld who won the battle here?
To be honest, I don't believe it. I think the president is always the person who calls the shots. The one thing that is true, there will be a reorganization in one form or another. I just don't think the final form is there yet.
Walter Pincus, staff writer for The Washington Post. Walter, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Glasgow-based company Traffic announced the release of a new video game to coincide with today's 41st anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Called JFK Reloaded, it allows players to recreate the three shots fired in Dallas by Lee Harvey Oswald. The president's brother, Senator Ted Kennedy, has called the game offensive. The makers say it's meant to disprove conspiracy theories. Well, there may be a much better way to do that. Investigative reporter and author Max Holland has written what critics are calling a reasoned and often poignant analysis of the assassination and its aftermath. His new book is called The Kennedy Assassination Tapes. It's a revealing new look at the hours of phone conversations Lyndon Johnson had in the aftermath of November 22nd, as the Warren Commission, headed by Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren, took form and made its final report. Max Holland joins us. And I want to start first with the Homeric arc. How did LBJ change as you listen to the tapes?
Well, he starts out, he's against the idea of a Warren Commission. He wants to leave the investigation with the FBI at a federal level and state authorities in Texas. And he's only persuaded by two factors. One is the specter of competing congressional investigations in an election year. It's a month away from 1964. Johnson was also worried because Oswald had been to Mexico City about 6 weeks before the assassination, had visited the Soviet and Cuban missions. We knew that because of CIA surveillance. And if it came out that we knew that and how we knew it, not only would we lose that method of surveillance, but the Mexican government would be extremely embarrassed because they cooperated in gathering such intelligence.
I think we have some tape of LBJ expressing some of the discomfort with a Warren Commission early on.
Apparently some lawyer in justice is lobbying with the Post because that's where the suggestion came from for this presidential commission, which we think would be very bad. Put it right in the White House, and we can't be checking up on every shooting spree in the country.
President Johnson talking about the prospects of the federal government studying the JFK assassination as if that were just another local shooting scrape. But Max Holland, you write that he then began to work tirelessly to get people onto the commission and then tried to sort out all the information coming at him. For instance, tapes show that then FBI Director Edgar Hoover tells LBJ rumors as if those rumors were true.
Right. Hoover was 64 years old by that time. And he was incapable of admitting to the president that he didn't have an answer for every question. If Johnson asked him a question, he'd rather give the president bad information than say, Mr. President, I don't know that yet. I'll tell you as soon as I can find out. So his conversations are very interesting. And one of the things he does, though, is create in Johnson the sense that there's more to the story than Oswald possibly acting alone. And, of course, it's fair to speculate early on because not everyone knows all the answers.
In fact, we have a portion of a conversation between LBJ and Georgia Senator Richard Russell. He's a member of the Warren Commission, and it seems as if Russell is saying that he doesn't believe the findings of the commission, that Oswald acted alone in killing Kennedy and wounding Texas Governor John Connally. Let's listen to Russell speak.
Well, they were trying to prove that the same bullet that hit Kennedy first was the one that hit Connally. Went through him and through his hand, his bone, into his leg, and everything else, just a lot of stuff that I couldn't hear all the evidence and cross-examine all of them. But I did read the record, and so I just, I don't know, I was the only fellow there that practically suggested any change whatever and what the staff had got up. This staff business always scares me. I like to put my own views down.
Max Holland, LBJ goes on to agree with Russell. Your thoughts about that exchange, which a lot of people take to mean that LBJ never believed the Warren Commission's findings.
Right. This is one of the reasons I did the book, because it's completely misrepresented and taken out of context. There are actually not talking about the finding that Oswald did it. They're talking about the single bullet conclusion or theory.
The single bullet theory being that one single bullet went through President Kennedy and into Mr. Connolly.
Right. And that was the signal forensic finding of the Warren Commission, the most important thing that they really did. And Governor Connolly wanted his own bullet. He didn't want to believe that he had been injured incidentally, mm-hmm. whether it was psychological or post-traumatic stress, I don't know. But Russell, because of his antagonism towards Warren, would not sign the Warren Report if it contradicted the sworn testimony of an honorable Southern governor. And this is an instance where Russell's intervention was very harmful because he wasn't that knowledgeable about the forensic facts. He just took Connolly's word. He didn't understand why the staff developed this theory for very sound factual forensic reasons. So he said, I'm not going to sign the report. So here again, they massaged the language, and it is a very confused, contradictory paragraph. Russell says, I'm not going to sign it. I don't believe that single bullet theory. And Johnson says, well, I don't either. Well, Johnson doesn't even know what it is.
Well, what difference did it make which bullet got Connolly?
Well, it don't make much difference, but they said that they believe, that the commission believed that the same bullet that hit Kennedy hit Connolly. Well, I don't believe it.
I don't either.
Well, there's still an arc of development as he gets more information. He was satisfied after the Warren Report came out that Oswald was the shooter in Dealey Plaza, and he really doesn't express many beliefs after that. But beginning in 1967, he hears information that radically changes his view and fixes his position. He finds out that there's a possibility that the CIA tried to kill Castro using hoodlums.
We should clarify here. You're saying that LBJ heard in 1967 about a CIA plot to kill Castro years earlier during the Kennedy presidency.
Right. At first, he dismisses this as having the credibility of someone coming up to him and telling him that his wife was a heroin addict. But because of some other developments, he asks the FBI if this is true. And to his astonishment, the FBI sends back a memo saying, the title of which is something like, CIA's Use of Hoodlums to Assassinate Castro. So this is about 7 years, 7 to 8 years before the American people know this to be the truth. And so Johnson, from that moment on, believes that despite what the Warren Report said, Castro had to be involved because we were trying to kill him. Hmm. Richard Helms tells him there was no connection between Castro and Oswald. Warren tells him there was no connection that they could find. But that doesn't matter. That's what Johnson believes. So he believes Oswald committed all the violence in Dealey Plaza, but he still believes he was encouraged or directed or somehow aided by Havana. And he goes to his grave thinking that.
Max Holland, author of The Kennedy Assassination Tapes. When we come back, more conversations from the LBJ tapes, including the toughest calls he had to make to JFK's widow, Jackie. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking with Max Holland, author of The Kennedy Assassination Tapes, The White House Conversations of Lyndon B. Johnson. And Max, we want to hear more of those conversations, particularly one with JFK's widow. But so much has been written on this topic. Why did you decide to write more?
Well, this is history with the Barkoff. This is what really happened in Johnson's own voice.
It's also history that we may have heard before, but it seems as if you're either listening a little more closely or with a little bringing a little more knowledge to it. I'm thinking of the one exchange that people have heard between a member of the Warren Commission and LBJ in a private moment. Why don't you set this up for us? There's one word that I think you point out may have been misunderstood.
Right. In Michael Beschloss's book, first book on the Johnson tapes, he used a conversation, a very important conversation that occurs on September 18th, 1964. It's the day the Warren Commission met for the last time to decide the final language of the report. And Beschloss transcribed the conversation between Richard Russell, the Georgia senator who was on the commission, and Johnson, as Russell saying, I wanted to put in a little old dissent, but every time I tried, they'd give me a little old threat.
Now remind us, dissent from what?
The staff wanted to say flat outright that there was no conspiracy. Russell said he wouldn't sign the report if it said that because he felt the commission hadn't had full access to the Soviet and Cuban records involving Oswald. So they massaged the language, and the report actually says, based on the information available to the commission, we find no evidence of a conspiracy. So they massaged the language until they incorporated Russell's dissent. And what he had really said to President Johnson in describing this process, I tried to get a little old dissent, but every time I tried, they'd give me a little old thread of it.
Thread with a D.
Thread with a D.
Well, let's give a listen.
Yes, sir. I tried my best to get in a dissent, but they'd come around and trade me out of it by giving me a little old thread of it, too.
That does sound a little more like thread than threat. But why were you more inclined to think it was thread?
Russell detested Warren, and the idea that Warren would threaten him or issue a threat or do anything of that nature and that Russell would bow to it was just incredible to me. I just thought it couldn't possibly be true, or I don't understand what went on. So I immediately listened to the tape, and I realized the transcript was wrong and that if Warren had threatened him, he would have, all hell would have broken loose.
Right. And what does he mean by thread? He means they just gave me a little fishing line or something?
They gave him a little of the language that he sought, a little of the qualification that he wanted to insert.
Yeah. Boy, to read your book is to watch LBJ wrestle with a spider web of information. The whole country was, but he had to.
You just point an interesting thing, which is that if you listen to Johnson wrestling with this, you realize despite the fact that he's president, you would think have every piece of information at his fingertips, he's wrestling with the same questions everybody else was.
He does it with rage, frustration, and in his exchanges with Jackie Kennedy, tremendous tenderness. Let's listen to one.
I just wanted you to know you were loved and by so many and so much.
Oh, Mr.
I'm
President,
one of them.
I tried. I didn't dare bother you again, but I got Kenny O'Donnell over here to give you a message, if he ever saw you. Did he give it to you yet?
No.
About my letter? That was waiting for me last night.
Listen, sweetie, now, first thing you got to learn, you got some things to learn, and one of them is that you don't bother me. You give me strength.
But I wasn't going to send you in one more letter, and I was
don't
just scared
anything.
You'd answer.
Don't send me anything. You just come over and put your arm around me. That's all you do. When you haven't got anything else to do, let's take a walk. Let's walk around the backyard and just let me tell you how much you mean to all of us and how we can carry on if you give us a little strength.
But you know what I want to say to you about that letter? I know how rare a letter is in a president's handwriting. Do you know that I've got more in your handwriting than I do in Jack's now?
No.
Max Holland, that's heartbreaking.
Right. It's the side of Johnson we never saw in public. He's extremely supportive and worried about Mrs. Kennedy in the days after the assassination. She lives in the White House for some time afterwards.
And yet many Americans didn't know that, and they accused LBJ of what, being dismissive of Mrs. Kennedy?
Not paying sufficient, using her, you know, forcing her to pose with him on Air Force One when he was sworn
using
in,
her. Yeah.
You know, sprawling on the bed and acting gleeful practically at the prospect of becoming president.
Yeah. Max Holland, who's written this book about the Kennedy assassination tapes, at least as the thoughts recorded by President Johnson in the aftermath of the assassination, what do we learn from this?
The assassination just didn't cast a pall over Johnson at the beginning of his term. It cast a pall over his whole presidency, and that his feelings about who was responsible and his anger at the Kennedys and sort of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party for accusing him of failing to be true to the legacy of John Kennedy were like existential blows, he felt. And I believe that's the reason he refused to run in 1968, that he had taken Kennedy's program, which was stalled in Congress, and had done more to advance it into legislation than anyone could have dreamed of. And yet he was being betrayed. Robert Kennedy was running against him with the claim that Johnson had not been true to the Kennedy legacy, and that was very burden too much for Johnson to bear.
And it's important to have that record straight, but why else would that resonate now, if it does?
Well, we have a similar situation with 9/11, I think. We have a report that's controversial that some people feel isn't the full truth. Right now they're enjoying kind of a honeymoon. But if the Warren Report is any guide, in 2 or 3 years we're going to have all these theories about what really happened. And although there are differences between the situations, it would be a terrible thing if we develop this whole deep conspiracy kind of thinking about 9/11 that's come to dominate the Kennedy assassination. I mean, right now we know a lot more about the Kennedy assassination than we knew in 1964, frankly. There were things that, you know, wasn't publicly disclosed that we'd been trying to kill Castro. Now, of course, that doesn't change the conclusion of the Warren Report, but some people think it was important to know.
Max Holland, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
Reporter Max Holland's new book is called The Kennedy Assassination Tapes, The White House Conversations of Lyndon B. Johnson Regarding the Assassination, the Warren Commission, and the Aftermath. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. As part of a deal with the European Union, the government of Iran has announced a halt to all uranium enrichment activities. The statement comes amid tough talk from President Bush about Iran's nuclear program, talk which led outgoing Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage to suggest that the president was playing bad cop to the EU's good cop negotiators. Meanwhile, the battle between conservative clerics and reformers in Iran has gone virtual. In the last few years, Iran's judiciary has shut down over 100 reform-minded publications, which forced many journalists to the Internet. And today, there are over 100,000 Iranian web blogs. But web blogging can be risky. Over the past 6 weeks, about 20 journalists and computer technicians in Iran have been detained after posting messages on the Internet. Well, joining us on the line from his home in Toronto is journalist Hossein Darakhshan. He's originally from Iran. He's been following events on his own website, stop.censoring.us. Hossein, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And also on the line from his office in Washington, D.C. is Joe Stork of Human Rights Watch. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Well, Hossein, to you first. In 2002, you wrote a how-to guide in Persian for Iranians who wanted to start blogging. What opportunities does it give them? What are the benefits for them?
They're practically now an alternative to newspapers, which have been closed down in the past year, in the past few years, lots of them, hundreds of them. So I think blogs now are functioning as a window to the Iranian society from outside, and to the world from inside Iran.
And what are the kinds of things that they might write on the blogs? Can you give us some examples? I don't know if you have anything open there in front of you.
Yeah. It's a range from very personal diary-style things that they write about. For example, their lives, their families, their friends, their schools and stuff like that, to political, social political commentary, which, of course, is rare because not a lot of these there are 70, 80,000 Persian weblogs out there now, but only a few percentage of this number are writing about political stuff. It's strange because even if you talk about your personal life, it is considered as political in Iran. You don't necessarily have to write about, for example, the sensitive issues, political issues in Iran. to be considered as political. If you talk about, for example, your underground lives as a young boy or girl in Iran,
it's dating, dating,
drinking, Western music, or even these simple things, they would be considered as politically incorrect.
Yeah, but Joe, the Iranian government, or we should say the conservative clerics in Iran, have made it difficult for people to read the blogs, right?
Well, they have. That's right. They've been closing them down. The wonderful thing about blogging is that, you know, relative to starting up a newspaper or something, it's easy to launch another site.
Well,
yes, they've been systematically shutting them down.
And Hossein, I find it interesting. You do reach people. How many hits do you get a day?
My weblog is filtered now, so it's officially blocked in many Iranian ISPs, but I still get about 6,000 per day.
Wow. More than newspapers in Iran.
More than some newspapers, yeah.
Joe Stork, we understand that the more moderate president of Iran has spoken out against the arrests of bloggers in Iran. So am I correct in guessing that it's the conservative clerics who are behind those arrests?
Oh, it definitely is. Mr. Khatami has spoken out pretty consistently against the crackdown on dissent, the crackdown on various modalities of free expression, the newspapers and journals we were talking about earlier. The problem is that his speaking out or his clear views on the matter have not in any way obstructed the steady clampdown, the growing acuity of that clampdown.
And they're working on a new law, Hossein, that will punish anyone who uses the Internet for disturbing the public mind.
That's right. They're working on some official legislation, particularly about the cyberspace and stuff like that. And one part of it is because, to prevent this political problems that it might face.
Yeah. What might that include, disturbing the public mind?
It's a wide range of topics. You could mainly, it starts with talking about the leader or criticizing him and the bodies that are under his authority.
Yeah, we're pointing out, I should point out, the leader is the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, not
right.
Mr. Khatami.
The clerical leader.
Yeah, he's the biggest taboo.
Yeah.
There are other taboos like Israel, some Islamic concepts like hijab, or some other religious things. Even if you talk about, as I said, drinking or personal life or these sort of hobbies, they could consider as undermining the national security.
I mean, the wonderful thing about a phrase like disturbing the public mind is it can mean anything they decide it to mean on a given day.
Yeah. Well, Joe Stork, what's going to happen to these people?
Well, obviously, given the state of the judiciary in Iran and the justice system in Iran, it's quite possible that they'll be convicted. I mean, many, many people, many, many journalists and writers over the years have been convicted, are doing long jail terms now because of what they've written.
You know, Hossein, I wonder, do you suspect that the clergy in Iran would just assume there was no Internet at all?
We are seeing some signs that they're very disturbed about this freedom of Internet that people have and the ineffectiveness of their technical ways to control it, I mean, filtering. Mm-hmm. So they're talking about some project called Shara-2, which is basically an intranet that disconnects Iran's Internet from outside world. And it's very dangerous. We don't know yet if it is practical or if they really want to do that, but they're talking about it at least.
Yeah. Well, the one thing we do know, history tells us that journalism will out. You know, people will get through a story even if it's, you know, banging on drums. But so do you think that this, you know, hard line attitude towards bloggers is going to stop them or create more?
I think it cannot stop them, but it'll make people to be more cautious and not to use their real names to blog and to make them on free servers which are not basically in Iran, because there is a very popular blogging service in Iran called PersianBlog.com, which hosts the majority of these Iranian web blogs. Mm-hmm. I think that would change.
Hossein Darakhshan, a journalist originally from Iran who's now got his own website in Toronto, and Joe Stork of Human Rights Watch in Washington. And for more information on Hossein's website, go to ours, here-now.org. Still to come, Valerie Hemingway. She was Ernest Hemingway's secretary. She was also married to the author's estranged son. Now she's out with a memoir about her life with the colorful family. It's called Running with the Bulls. You're listening to Here and Now. Television news shows across the country are replaying it over and over again, the ugly brawl between fans and players at Friday night's NBA game between the Detroit Pistons and the Indiana Pacers. Pacers star Ron Artest has been suspended for the rest of the season. Steven Jackson was given a 30-game suspension, Jermaine O'Neal 25. Pistons center Ben Wallace received a 6-game suspension, while Pacers guard Anthony Johnson was ordered to sit out 5 games. Joining us on the line, Jeff Benedict. He's an investigative reporter and author of Out of Bounds, Inside the NBA's Culture of Rape, Violence, and Crime. And Jeff, this brawl was violent. Was it a crime?
It very well could have been not just a crime, but multiple crimes. I think we could anticipate the potential for criminal charges against possibly some players, but perhaps some fans as well.
We'll remind people who haven't seen the tape, which is you have to have not been near a television set. It's been replayed so many times. There was a shove, there was a foul, then suddenly there was a melee, beer thrown, punches thrown.
Yeah, it is probably the most violent altercation that we've seen in American sports. It involved many players and even more fans. It went on for quite a long time, up into the stands. It was a surreal scene to see something like that on television.
And children weeping, women running away. What's happening?
Well, one of the things I think that's happening is the NBA has been inching toward this. Over the past few years, there's been a buildup. There's been players who have had altercations with officials. There's been spitting on fans. There's been altercations with coaches. And now they've had a full-scale brawl in the stadium with the fans.
And some are saying that it's had a direct effect on other games. There was a Clemson, South Carolina football game, college game over the weekend, a fight there as well.
Yeah, in that game, I don't know how much relationship there is between that and this NBA brawl, but in that game, there were actually law enforcement officials that ended up getting swept up in the brawl on the football field.
And there was also a youth football game in Cranston, Rhode Island. Some people there are speculating that that brawl, which spilled onto the football field and started in the stands and 3 people were arrested, might also have been sort of a spillover from the NBA game. But some people are saying, you know, is the punishment from the NBA, some people are shocked at it, but is it harsh enough?
Well, first of all, I don't think harsh is a good adjective. I think the punishment that the commissioner handed out, particularly the 1-year suspension for Artest, is appropriate. I mean, this was an incredibly violent altercation.
And what will it cost him? Do we know?
Well, he makes about $70,000 per game, and he's missing, I think it probably totals around $4 million that he could, you know, sacrifice over the course of the suspension.
Yeah. Well, that's the players. What about the fans? One column, a New York columnist, said in the end they were to blame.
That the fans are to blame?
Mm.
Well, look, there's plenty of responsibility to go around. You can't isolate the players and the fans. They both played a role in this, as did the role, I think, of alcohol, which is sold widely at sporting events. And clearly, by the look of what was going on that tape, you had some people who had too much to drink, who were throwing their alcohol on these players and fueling this, and it's going to cause the NBA to review their alcohol sales policy. The commissioner's already said that.
Well, Jeff Benedict, the players that were involved in the altercation were enraged. They were provoked, but they were enraged. We know that one of the symptoms of people using performance-enhancing drugs is rage. Should they be asked for urine samples?
Well, you know, This is a loaded question because the scene was bizarre and it was sort of surreal to see it. And when you think about what provoked it, you have two players that got into a fight on the court, and then you had a player on the sidelines who had some liquid thrown on him, who then went into a rage and charged into the stands. I wasn't there. I couldn't hear what was said prior to that. There's a lot of speculation about what triggered it because it doesn't seem to square with the conduct that followed. Steroid use has become a more and more volatile and controversial issue, and so have other kinds of performance-enhancing drugs, particularly with the Olympics and Major League Baseball of late. The NBA has largely escaped the microscope of steroids. I wouldn't be surprised, however, in light of what's been going on recently, if the NBA starts to come under some more questions about steroid use, and it should.
Jeff Benedict, author of Out of Bounds, Inside the NBA's Culture of Rape, Violence, and Crime. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Traveling with Ernest was never dull. He was a man of extremes, and he had the gift of being able to impart his pleasure and enthusiasm to those around him. He unleashed his imagination and could be deeply sensitive. But there was a dark side. An enemy was a deadly enemy, usually for keeps. A grudge was jealously guarded, and loyalty and friendship was demanded. He had the most inquiring mind of anyone I've ever met.
That's Valerie Hemingway, reading from her memoir, Running with the Bulls, My Years with the Hemingways. The book recalls the personal and professional relationship she had with members of the writer's family, including her years as Ernest's personal secretary, as well as her 20-year marriage to his estranged son, Gregory. Recently, Valerie spoke with Here Now's Bill Marks.
I was completely ignorant of his reputation. And when I met Hemingway, I was in Madrid working for a Belgian news service and sending back freelance articles to the Irish Times. I was sent to interview Hemingway. And it was almost as if the interview went back to front. He started asking me questions. He said, what was I doing in Spain? How was I pursuing my journalism? And I told him I was following what was going on in the Irish community and sending these kind of dispatches back to the Irish Times. And he said, you're going all the wrong way about it. You know, if you come to a country, you forget your own country, you learn everything about the country that you are now in. And so he said, of course you're planning on going to Pamplona. And I said, well, no, actually I hadn't. And he said, well, you must do that. And then he said, well, but you know, it's a bit late now. You'll not get a room there unless we book one for you. So within minutes, it was scheduled that I would go up to Pamplona. So I just knew that fate had decided.
I want to ask a little bit about when you became part of the Hemingway Rat Pack. He called the group his quadrilla, and that was when you were in your late teens. What was it like being part of that group, and what did you see in Hemingway, and why did Hemingway select you to become part of this merry band?
Well, I became part of the pack up in Pamplona, and I think Hemingway was quite amused that I was not a groupie, that I was not a fan of his, in that I'd read his books, but he was by not close to being my favorite author. And he continually tried to prove himself, you know, saying, take these short stories and read them, tell me what you think. So he was trying to prove to me what a great writer he was.
Now, from Spain, you went to Cuba with the Hemingways, so you continued to be with them. And it's a place, of course, Cuba is a place where Hemingway loved and had a home there. But this is also after the revolution, so the Cuba had changed quite a bit. Can you talk a little bit about Hemingway's last extended time in Cuba?
Yes. Well, I came down to Cuba in January of 1960, and for me it was an enchanting place because it was my first time ever in the tropics. And in Cuba, Ernest wrote every morning. He swam in the pool, went out fishing on the Pilar. Mary loved her garden. But then after I was there 2 or 3 months, a sort of shadow was cast over the life, because the United States was withdrawing diplomatic relations with Cuba, and that he would have to go back. And this and other things, like his health was failing, his eyesight was failing, so a depression started to set in before we left Cuba, and that was the last time Ernest was there.
Well, I think that one of the things in this book, that because a lot of memoirs have been written about Papa Hemingway, And I think one of the more valuable things in this book, which may be one of the last ones certainly to be written by someone who knew him for an extended period of his time, is on the one hand, you talk about how people don't know why Hemingway committed suicide. But it seems to me that in this book you provide a number of quite logical or understandable reasons about why he did what he did.
Well, I think I was able to do that because I did live it day by day. And even though I was young, with Ernest, the most important thing in his life was writing. And when he felt he couldn't do it well, he said many times that he didn't want to continue, that that was the purpose of his life. And if that was taken away, then the life was worthless.
He remained a friend of Mary's after Ernest's death. And I'd like you to read a humorous passage, at least one that I laughed out loud when I read it, and that's on page 203. And now after Ernest has died, Mary found a papa-like way to fend off the tourists from the house.
That fall, a steady stream of curious tourists first went to the cemetery and then came to the house to look and take photographs. Mary could see them from her bedroom window. The initial annoyance turned to fury, and she would grab her shotgun from the rack in the living room. A warning shot would raise a little gravel and stir up dust in front of their windshields, and if they did not take heed, the tire would be the next target. I admired her spunk and no-nonsense approach. The word got around, and then we were mostly left in peace.
I can understand that. Now, your connection with Hemingway did not end with Ernest. Of course, you were put in charge of dealing with a lot of the papers and letters and so forth and manuscripts that were left after he died. And you also met his estranged son, Gregory, at the funeral, and you married him for over 20 years. Tell us a little bit about your late husband. He died in 2001 in a woman's prison.
Yes, well, Greg was, he was a wonderful person in many ways. I loved him very much, and he had what he called a tragic flaw, and that was he was a transvestite. And this was the deep secret that I had heard some dark secret being alluded to when I was with the Hemingways. The only thing Ernest ever said to me about Greg was, I had Giggy, he called him, was my best son, but he went bad. And I had no idea what he went bad meant. And when I met and married Greg, I just couldn't even imagine. In fact, when I met him, I completely forgot that there were any that there were any whisperings or problems. And it wasn't, a few years into our marriage, I noticed little things around, like a pair of stockings or some lipstick that I knew didn't belong to me. And as the years went on, he found it harder and harder to cope. And, eventually we parted and, very sadly, as you said, he died in a women's prison because I think a few years before he died, he actually had a sex change.
And your life has been so connected with the Hemingway family. I mean, you came from a very dysfunctional or troubled family background yourself. So in a sense, they adopted you. You adopted them as a sort of surrogate family in some ways. Do you ever think what your life would have been like had you not met Ernest Hemingway back in 1959 and had taken that reporting assignment?
I probably would still be sitting in some Dublin. I don't know whether I'd be married there with a family, but I definitely would have stayed in Dublin, I think. But I'm so glad. I mean, I have to say, with all the ups and downs, and that I'm really glad that my life has been as interesting as it has.
Thank you so much. It's been so good talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Valerie Hemingway speaking with Here and Now's Bill Marks. For more information on her book, Running with the Bulls, My Years with the Hemingways, check out our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.